Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is part 2 of episode 3 on the theory of human motivation by Abraham Maslow. To get Maslow's paper and for more information, please go to www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1, please go and do so, as this is a continuation of that discussion. And now, back to the conversation.
Okay, so I think I want to follow that more empirical direction that Ralph was going and reason a bit more, and I would love to see your inputs, guys, about that, on the applicability, if you will, of Maslow on today's low practices. Because I was thinking very hard in what are the points that you think that you see, you know, relevant and almost became common sense today. So one we talked about was this idea of, you know, giving some space, 20% or 10% of employees to do their own thing at work. But I think there are other couple of points. We also mentioned a bit about gratification, which we think in relation to what we were saying before about Fayol and Taylor, is quite a powerful idea. You know, it's not only about sanctions, it's also about incentives and gratification. So it's a very common HRM policy, I think, nowadays. But there were another couple of things that came to mind to me. One, I think, has to do with the allocation of personnel. He talks about this thing, you know, about you should put individuals in things that they are very fitted for. You know, he doesn't say necessarily about work, but, you know, individuals should be in place that they are fitted and they feel they contribute and they feel, you know, well there. So I think it relates to this idea of, you know, if you have a matrix organization, for instance, and you have to sparse people across different projects, and I think this relates to this thing of the ships that we're talking about, you know, in which kind of missions you send people and what's going to fit different for different people. What's your views on that?
So one comment I have about relevance, and that is, I just started thinking about, based on what Pedro said, about the safety, security in the hierarchy of going off to esteem and self-actualization, which is, I think, where a lot of companies say they want their workers in this fully developing themselves and becoming more effective at what they do in the organization. So maybe that's the organizational sense of self-actualization. One of the things that strikes me about that thinking in today's workplace is I don't see a lot of emphasis addressing employees' job-related safety and security needs. So you'll see companies do massive downsizing or big layoffs, and it almost puts the employees in this sense of shock. And in fact, there's been some studies that I've heard about that it's almost like people go through post-traumatic stress disorder because of this sense of shock they have of losing the connection to the people that they knew. Mm-hmm. And so I think that some of those, you can have these jolts to the system that either throw you back some levels or reverses the hierarchy. Maslow says several times, in a good society, these kind of safety needs are taken care of. And I would say in organizations, that's often not so because of the dynamic events that go on in organizations. So that's one thing about relevance that occurred to me.
For me, one of the things that stands out when we speak of allocation of personnel and sort of applying the whole theory of motivation to the workplace is how on earth do you do that? If we speak of things like pursuing self-actualization or even other slightly lower needs, these are deeply personal, I think. So how is it that you're supposed to identify and actualize these needs in an organized collective way?
I think, well, at least the company I was studying for the PhD, you know, this big engineering company, since it's the kind of place that people tend to stay for a long time, it's a kind of old school long-term employment place, they have like official personal development plans that every year people sit down with their manager, says what they think they get feedback from the supervisors, they said what they see themselves becoming more advanced in the technical track or the managerial track, and their suggestions of course they might do, and, you know, kind of projects they would like to be engaged. So I think there is some kind of way to keep track of that.
I can agree with you, although I want to go back to what Dimitri said, because I think he had made a really interesting point that I really hadn't thought about till he said it. And that was this idea that in the general theory, Maslow portrays the sort of the lower level needs, so maybe below self-esteem, as kind of standard ways to satisfy those things. You know, for example, you just get food and then you're done. You know, that's you have enough food in. And Dimitri made the point, which I thought was excellent, that there's more individualism in those, in satisfying those basic needs than we might think. And therefore, it becomes very difficult to say if we make sure that, for example, that Pedro has bologna and white bread sandwiches, is that going to take care of his, you know, is that going to take care of his hunger, for to use sort of a trivial example? Whereas, you know, whereas if, and you, I think you talked about earlier, Pedro, when you were talking about, kind of depends on how you're raised and what your background is and stuff. And so if you were raised to really value food and the differences in food, and yet I'm, you know, I'm more American, so, you know, meat and potatoes, and that's all I really care about, which is not true, by the way, then we're going to have sort of different approaches to that. By analogy, you could say, well, that's going to make it difficult in organizations to say, how do we satisfy the safety or esteem needs from people or some of these other those lower levels, the more foundational aspects of the hierarchy? So I thought that was a really interesting point that Dimitri has said, because I'm not sure if people have thought through that.
That's true.
Well, I think unless you're as committed as Google, you probably normally fall to the lowest common denominator. And maybe not, but I have a very vivid, somewhat traumatic experience of that. Before going into academia, when I was working in underwater technology, I spent about a month on this boat where they would serve the same plastic spaghetti every day for lunch. And even after a week, no amount of ketchup or any other seasonings would make it. Basically, the meal was something you had to do because you needed the energy. And even then, it was done very, very quickly and to almost taking the plaster off. So,
on this note, I just want to say to Ralph that I prefer sandwiches with cream cheese and salmon and rocket salad instead of bologna and whatever.
Okay, that's good. And I think Demetrius just helped me make my point even better, in that you got an organization there that, sure, maybe they're way to the other end of the spectrum from Google, and yet they're not even considering any value added by some differentiation. Because I will tell you, on submarines, basically do not come up above the surface. And so you basically don't look out the window, you don't see mountains, you don't see sunrise, you don't see sunset. The Navy's view is that food is very, very important. So it's not just purely a satisfaction need to be met. It's a very important motivator and contributes greatly to your general attitude towards work. I think Demetrius gave a great example of a company that doesn't see it that way, and which may be acceptable for if it's menial labor, right? We were talking about those differences.
I think I have a hard question. I was wondering, our discussion, we are trying to think Maslow inside organizational theory, and he has been used there. But I was wondering, are we actually forcing him somewhere that he doesn't belong? Because, I mean, I don't know if he says explicitly that you're supposed to get fulfillment in all these needs at work or from work. So maybe we keep thinking, can we stretch it? Is it okay? Does it fit?
Yes. I think there is one aspect that we are overlooking. That is the fact that Maslow was a psychologist. So his work was definitely more of a general nature, and it was conceptualized in order to be applied to a wide variety of settings. While actually what we are doing is carrying it to only one context, the organizational one, the workplace. And this definitely may be the source of many issues.
I think you may be right about that. And I think perhaps what we suffer from in organizational theory, or maybe it's the way it's applied, maybe it's not organizational theory, is that I wouldn't say stretching Maslow too far. I would say maybe homogenizing it so much to make it easy to understand. Remember, I think it was Miranda, somebody was saying, we've lost some of that nuance of Maslow. When you read him, what he actually wrote, you say, oh, okay, this is sort of a general guide. And yet that's often not the way it's applied or taught to people. It's more like, okay, here's this hierarchy and you have to get all these things done before you go to... But I mean, it wasn't until I read this text that I think I understood, and maybe I was taught this, I just don't remember, that I understood that you could have these percentages and the percentages can vary amongst individuals and you can have some of these things swap around. That's why I really enjoyed having a chance to read the original, actually for the first time.
Me too. That was the first time I read it.
Well, the percentages bit is something that I really like, and that's something that really frustrates me at the same time. On one hand, it's a relief to find out that it's not this mechanistic step-by-step ladder to self-actualization, which is something I want to talk about later still. But on the other hand, if it's percentages and if it's a mixture, which makes sense, how does this hierarchy help us in any possible way? How is this an improvement on James's thing that I mentioned about material, social, and spiritual? What's the point? If it's percentages, which he doesn't describe, by the way, there's no formula. He just says arbitrarily that if it's 60% of basic needs, maybe you can get 20% of the safety needs and that sort of thing. Basically, why?
Well, I'm not sure I could speak for anybody else or why organizations... Others might find this useful, but I think there is value, even though, as you said, Maslow's not the first one to look at these sort of dimensions, these sort of different dimensions of people, so let's start with Taylor, and you say, okay, well, Taylor is looking from an engineering process point of view and just saying, okay, people come to work and they want to get paid and we'll very precisely define the work. And then we looked at Fayol, and Fayol was talking more about how managers should approach this sort of top-down approach to organizing their work. So I think Maslow was... For me, anyway, it's a nice, and that's why I kind of like the order. I don't know who the brilliant person was that came up with the order, but of the readings, but I like the way now we're starting to say, well, there's more to it than that, and these people have these needs, and there tends to be this hierarchy, although Maslow talks about how it's not a one-size-fits-all model for all, and there's ways that the percentages can vary. So I would say, as a preload to that, as a manager, that means you do have to pay attention to, you know, what's going on in people's lives. So here's a practical example. In Naval Aviation, they realize that if you are having domestic problems at home or you have a sick child, your mind is not going to be on the highest skill levels, and so a form of that is self-actualization. The highest skill levels as a pilot, you will be distracted as a pilot. And therefore, they actually have ways of evaluating those kinds of things in a non-punitive way, and they will pull people off of flight duty. It's called a flight status. So they'll take you out of flight status if you're going through very difficult problems at home, and or you're, you know, like you had a relative just die or something like that. And I've seen that in other parts of the Navy where we tried to actually account for that. So I think in perhaps more enlightened is not the best way to say it, but in some organizations, you realize you're dealing with whole people. People aren't just showing up for a paycheck every day. And I think people respond to that. They don't necessarily want their manager involved in all their personal details, but they respond to that kind of willingness of organizations to look at them as more nuanced. So that's why I think that's one way you can apply Maslow.
I just want to build on that. It's a great point and go back to what Dimitri was saying. I don't know his or her thought as well as you do, Dimitri, but don't you think that he's in a way adding meat to this idea, and which is powerful because then it has been so successful and has been taken up by, you know, organizational theory. So maybe that's his contribution there.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I'm not disputing the value of these ideas, and I'm certainly not saying that we would have been just as well off had he not formulated this theory. I guess my concern, and it's a minor concern, so I guess I don't want to dwell too much on it, is given that there is pretty much no empirical substantiation to this work, and there doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of conceptual substantiation either, because thinking of what makes people tick has been going on since recorded history of thought, pretty much. Why is this work so popular?
Well, I will tell you, because I was taught this as an undergraduate at the Naval Academy, and so one of the attractions is it's a nice, clear, crisp model. You can talk about these stages that people go through, and it's fairly easy to convey if you take out all the nuance that Maslow used. So like Taylor, right? Maslow can be misused or misrepresented just focusing on the stages and saying, well, I'm done. You have these stages, so take care of everything else, and here you go off into self-actualization. And so I think I think it's the way Maslow's been interpreted and used is what makes it so attractive to people. That's just my guess.
I don't know so much how he became so popular and why, but I think for me it's important because it's a strong counter argument to so many other basic theories, you know, that it's everything about pay or basic axioms that we have imported from economics, such as that individuals are just maximizing machines, they all want the same thing over and over, which is more money, more profit. He breaks that. He says that as we were saying before, there's layers, so it's not about the same thing that people want more. And the things that they want is not necessarily this individual thing. This is usually that would read as money, but also there's more social benefits, if you will. So I think it's a strong voice against, you know, this canon.
Well, maybe just maybe I'm reading a bit too much into it and seeing a story where there actually isn't one, but it could be that Maslow's hierarchy is so popular and attractive because it actually tells a kind of from rags to riches stories. So if we remember Maslow's biography, he goes from being the son of Jewish immigrants to a university professor. And these kind of stories where we overcome challenges and make our way in life towards our ultimate achievements, they've always had a good level of fascination.
That's a good point, because I think that connects to what Dimitri was saying earlier about the connection with Viktor Frankl, which is a sort of a similar idea. And I think Miranda makes a really good point when she talks about this climbing up the stages thing, because, you know, when you read, it's hard, at least I found it hard, when you're reading about esteem and self-actualization, it's hard not to look at it and say, yeah, that's where I want to be. That's, you know, I want to be the self-actualizing person, right? So there's this sort of aspirational aspect to it where I think Maslow maybe in some ways democratizes this, everybody can have this higher calling or this higher purpose. And that'd be one reason why it's very attractive to people.
Well, this is actually something that's unclear, what you just said, Ralph, because he writes on page 10, third paragraph from bottom, last sentence, what a man can be, he must be, right?
Yeah, I agree. I wrote that down.
Yeah, so what is this determinism that we're dealing with? What does it mean that what a man can be, he must be? Is it... All right, so two things are here at play for me. One is there some kind of a metaphysical trajectory where each individual is going, and then actualizing this trajectory is sort of the function of the hierarchy of needs, right? So is Pedro... Pedro is, for instance, destined to become a great sociologist, so that is what he is kind of going for. That is his form in this terrestrial existence. Or...
I'm rooting for you.
Let's hope so.
Or is it that, in a looser way, that what a man can be in terms of finding a meaningful outlet, a skill set, and certain capabilities that this man or woman may have, then they must strive to this to fulfill this, to find meaning in their life and work. And if it's the latter, then I think our mentioning of Viktor Frankl is extremely interesting, because I don't know if we all read Man's Search for Meaning, but if you go through that book, and we'll attach it in show notes, is you notice that whilst there's significant deprivation in basic needs, especially in safety, and needs such as self-esteem are completely out the window, he does describe how people manage to self-actualize. So it's not even that all the levels of the pyramid are there, and the ones that are certainly used in a different proportion than to what he tries to suggest.
I don't know much about Viktor Frankl, but I want to go back to what you said about the sentence, you know, what man can be, must be. I think it's actually very interesting because, I mean, it's all... Who is to decide? That's your point, I think. You know, is the person to decide? And what about when the person can be well in two different positions? You gave my example. So my supervisor usually jokes that I love baking. I usually bake and bring things, you know, to the office. That's, you know, should I be a baker or a sociologist? But if you think in companies, you know, if someone is very good in management and is very good in the more technical things, should he go or she go to the more administrative career? Should go to technical career? So that's a difficult... So is the organization they want to decide? Is the person they want to decide?
Well, even beyond that, that's not just who would decide, but how do you know?
Yes. I mean, I think that whole... that. So I think there's a bit of a paradox there, right? Because, and I think you bring up a really interesting way of looking at it. So there's this idea, there's sort of this deterministic aspect. If you look at a strong interpretation of the what man can be, he must be, right? With that, because I read the same thing and thought, must. You know, what does that really mean? That he will be forever unhappy if they're not... You know, the person's not developing themselves, or there'll be a source of dissatisfaction. And then he talks later about the need to develop one's skills, and I think that relates back to the self-esteem and the need for admiration or social connection with other people. And so I think it's a bit of both. I think there are... So I think for some people, yes, there's the... It's, we were talking about creativity earlier, or maybe entrepreneurs, right? So what a man can be or a woman can be, they must be, and they have this strong, intense desire. And then I think there's others for whom it's, I'm not saying it's not the same. I think it's not the same. I don't think the motivation is the same. And I think you can interpret Maslow that way. I just think in that one sentence, that was a very strong way to say it. So I think that only applies, and based on my personal experience, to a small number of people, because I think he talks about, I forget where in the text, about the courage and confidence people have to overcome obstacles, you know, those kinds of things. And so, yes, some people have that, but not everyone.
Yeah. So let's expand on that. So the question could be, are all employees to be motivated? Is motivation essential?
So what do you mean, motivation in the workplace?
Should you care about that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's as well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't... Maybe that's too strong a way to say it. But certainly for people who are going to become more self-actualized or, you know, develop in their potential, like you were talking about earlier about the people that the development conversation people had to have with their managers. If you're not motivated, and certainly a lot of your basic needs aren't fulfilled, it will be difficult for you. I'm not saying it won't be possible. It's just, I think that complicates things. And so I think motivation is important. And then, but it goes back to what Dimitri said, a lot of that's very individualistic. And so what motivates one person isn't going to be motivate another. And that's what makes it difficult to apply Maslow in organizations, because if you say, well, here's the hierarchy and I'll take care of these things this way, Dimitri made that excellent point about, well, those are very individualistic things and it may not be motivating for everybody.
So it's not just that. It's also, as you said,
yeah.
And as you illustrated with the going to see example, that this cocktail of needs changes based on circumstances.
Yes, absolutely.
The only thing I was wondering is that, you know, I was trying to make a point just out there so I could, like, get to what I want to really want to get, is that how are we supposed to deal with boredom then? You know, because you think about many repetitive tasks. I'm not talking about knowledge workers, refined engineers, professionals, any people that do a very repetitive task every day, day after other. It's normal they'll be bored. So how are you going to conceptualize that in Maslow's ideas? You know, it doesn't fit there?
Well, you should not feed them as much and keep them not as safe.
Well, that's a really good point, Pedro. And I think that a part of what you see in modern organizations, is particularly amongst knowledge workers, is this idea that not only do you have to have varied experiences to develop expertise, but you actually, it's necessary, helpful mm-hmm. to sustain motivation, right? Because giving the people a changing cocktail, as Dimitri likes to say, of projects and things that tap into needs differently, that may be a way of saying, mm-hmm. well, we don't know exactly what motivates you, but we're going to try these different things or give you these different projects to help you tap into those things.
Yeah.
Well, it may be fulfilling.
But what about cashiers in supermarkets?
Shouldn't generalize certain occupations as inherently boring, but I can see how someone would be happy doing that for human interaction, for instance, and that might be
I agree. Yeah, so I will speak from experience. I worked as a waiter in my undergrad in Italy, and I completely hated it. You know, it was interesting at first and interesting sometimes, but most of the time I was just bored. So
yeah, that's a good question.
So was it in terms of the hierarchy, so, you know, did you hate it when you got the paycheck so you could eat?
No, I think hate is a strong word, but let's put it, I was bored for the most part. So that's my point.
Well, and that's interesting because that shows that what your calling was, or what you felt you wanted to do, wasn't actually touched very well or connected by the level of self-actualization that was possible, right? Because you can imagine a spectrum of tasks and capabilities as a waiter. And some people, when you go out, they have the waiter's wait staff or the server is very engaging, and they seem to really enjoy what they're doing. And so for some people, that may be their level of self-actualization, that this idea that they're mm-hmm. connected with their customers' needs and they're empathetic and, you know, those kinds of things. Because you can always tell, you have a tendency to be able to tell, and I'm sure particularly in your case, Pedro, when the waiter just really isn't very motivated, is just going through the motions kind of mechanistically, whereas somebody who really tries to engage with you and has a engaging and effervescent personality, it's a whole different experience with a server. So I think in that case, it didn't tap into what you needed.
The man you could be was beyond what the occupation enabled you to. So you became a waiter, I think, and then you couldn't go above that. Maybe that's one way of thinking about it.
Yeah, so can I make one point about that? So there now I can see what the man can be, he must be, right? Or what the person can be, they must be. Because there's a case where Pedro identified he needed to be something else. That was not what he needed to be, and therefore he felt that drive to do something else. So now I can see that a little bit better.
I think not as a standalone framework, and certainly not as a prescriptive framework. It certainly does well, I think, as we just illustrated, to describe in retrospect why something may or may not have worked out. But I was just thinking about when we did Taylor, we stumbled upon this caveat where he would not necessarily fire people when they could form a job, but try to move them elsewhere within the organization. And I'm also really itching to tell about this Ardent theory that probably shouldn't go into at this point, the stratified systems theory, that basically does the same thing, that identifying what job position you're best suited for as an individual. So I think there is value in terms of learning lessons of the past, but I don't know how much this could be used as an organizational design tool, as I think it has been misused in this way.
Well, so I would say in the Navy, U.S. Navy, we do try to use it to guide organizational design or development, maybe, because we do create positions or have the opportunity to create positions where you can see if somebody is not, their self-actualization needs are not being met in the current role. You have the flexibility to create new roles for them. And I think that's where there's some, because Maslow doesn't really address, go into detail, which is not a criticism. I think it just wasn't the purpose of his writing, that there's in the self-actualization aspect of it, I believe, and there's some writing about this, that it's a journey of self-discovery. You know, you don't wake up one day and say, oh, I want to be, you know, this is the kind of person I want to be. You're actually discovering it in the flow of events. And I think that's kind of what Pedro, you know, discovered, being a waiter and doing these kinds of activities. And it's all very interesting at first. And then you realized, okay, this is as high as I can go in this kind of activity, and it's not where I want to be. And so you're discovering more. I think you learned a lot about yourself in that kind of position. And then what you see in the organization is there are not many other roles for you other than a manager or something like that, because you have a very flat organization with a few people in hierarchy. And if there's already a manager, you may not be able to step into something like that. Whereas in the Navy or in other organizations, they try to be able to create positions for people.
I agree with all that. But I think my point is also that, you know, some people do not have the choice. I mean, I was just in waitering while I was doing my undergrad, so it was fine. I knew that's not going to make me up my
job
for life.
Okay.
But for other people that worked with me, it was. And they were bored as well. So sometimes, you know, structurally, you don't have the choice to pursue what you feel that you would like and everything else. So reality hits you.
Well, I think that's where the courage comes in and all those attributes that Maslow wants you to take your destiny by the horns and, you know, pursue it. I think that's also in concert with what Miranda said about Maslow's personal background.
Yeah. Well, and I think, so I want to make a comment about my understanding of entrepreneurship, right? What you see
that fit.
Some many states of entrepreneurship is it's a strong personal drive these people have to create and, you know, develop new things and be inventive and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's not a large fraction of the population that have that kind of courage and that energy and that zeal to do those kinds of things. So I think in many ways entrepreneurship is like, well, I know I'm changing the subject slightly, but I thought it would be fun to do that. It's like artistry, right?
Okay.
That's the same kind of desire to create and do something new, because you get these people that are serial entrepreneurs that try to do, start many companies.
That's actually a bit of a tricky point in the sense that it's a bit difficult to fit Maslow's hierarchy to entrepreneurship, especially because the studies in this field have mainly been concerned with showing why and how entrepreneurs are a different category of individuals, a category which needs to be set aside from others such as managers. So in this sense, the hierarchy probably needs to be adapted, especially because there are actually a wide range of motives which drive entrepreneurs to set up their own businesses. And this goes from ideas of autonomy and independence to risk orientation or to just the will to realize their own ideas in the shape of products and services.
Great point, because on the one hand, Maslow seems to be operating in the ideal type of this great person who would strive to fulfill their true being and be courageous in the process of doing that. But on the other hand, as you just pointed out, we all know of stories of these great entrepreneurs who would forego basic needs for the sake of, you know, running their business. So do you get a sense that this framework is sort of paradoxical in this way, that it's supposed to be general and yet it doesn't apply to its inspiration?
I mean he talks about in the text a bit that some people are
it's made out as a caveat
in light of others.
This is possible,
but of course
it's not the cornerstone of the theory, which I think maybe it should be.
Maybe that's what's missing. I'll just give you the example of Van Gogh, and he would not eat because he was the poor painter and so on and so forth, that he was story says, rumor has it that he would not eat sometimes just to be able to paint and buy, the materials and everything. So,
That's actually great. It's not just him. There's also in theology, there's these mystical branches or religions where people would deliberately forego basic needs with intent to self-actualize. So the ascetics, the early Christian ascetics, they would go out into the desert and basically survive on breadcrumbs of that in order to obtain this spiritual experience that would, I think, be of the self-actualizing value for them. Well, these are extreme cases, right? But I think they're warranted because he mentions this. He, in describing why the basic needs are such that he identified the food, water, sex, which is an odd one to be in there, but I guess depends on the individual. So when designating these needs as basic, he does talk about the extreme case of where someone deprived of food would only think of food and eating. So whilst it is extreme, and as I mentioned before, that we don't really come across such situations of extreme deprivation in our everyday lives, it's certainly there. So what's the main thing that we took away from this text?
I got a similar thing. I didn't think so much about the percentage, but it was the same direction. That for me was interesting that there is no pyramid actually. And what is for me, he's really saying is that people are these social beings that have this need for fulfillment, that they require differences in kind, not of degree. So we cannot give the same thing, money or anything that it is, for people, and that would be enough. So that for me is the take home lesson.
I think the main takeaway of this reading is given by the centrality of the individual, which in this case is conceptualized as a set of needs that in turn drive our behavior and guide our decisions.
For me, I think I'm still hung up all trajectory of where this pyramid is pointing to, whether it's search for meaning or whether it's this more deterministic thing. And that's probably just because of where I am in terms of what I'm reading. But other than that, I'm glad we read it, and I'm glad I'm not going to have to read it again, because whilst I agree with all the points that you made, and it hasn't been the most exciting text to read. And I think in terms of value that I got out of reading it, so far out of the three that we did, it's probably the lowest levels. But certainly something to go through. I mean, it's only like 20 pages long. And given what we come to learn about Maslow and the pyramid, it's definitely worth having a look at, I think. And that concludes episode 3 on the theory of human motivation. Thank you for listening. Next time we are going to do something a little bit different. Instead of reading one text and discussing it as we have done these past 3 episodes, we are going to look at the origins of the concept of organizational routines by reading 2 books, one by Simon and March and one by Syed and March, and both from what is now known as the Carnegie Mellon School of Management tradition. For more information on these, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and look out for supplements to episode 4 next week, where our very first and very special guest, Katharina, talks about the readings and about how they relate to one another. If you enjoyed this episode and like our podcast, please tell your friends and colleagues about us. Get in touch on Twitter and Facebook to tell us what you think, and leave a review on iTunes. Even a brief review can help new listeners find us there. Thank you for joining us, and I hope to see you next time as we look at the Carnegie Mellon School of Management with a special focus on organizational routines.